Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is January 10th, 2012, and I'm Slim Shady.
No, you're not. No, no, you're not. At least you're not the real Slim Shady. Let's put it that way.
Because you're sitting down.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
And Angela Meaden.
Hello.
And I am also known as Owen Swart. All right, let's start this week with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
In teaching Angela to appreciate history, one of us looks up some kind of interesting historical thing that is science or skepticism based, and it is in an effort to encourage me to appreciate history, as the name says.
So what does an American president during World War I have to do with science history, though?
Nothing.
Oh.
Oh. All right, then.
Okay, that's the end of the segment.
No, you doffball. So, we are recording this on January 10th, and on this day in 1936 was the birthday of Robert Woodrow Wilson, who won the 1978 Nobel Prize for Physics with his colleague Arno Penzias for their discovery of the cosmic microwave background.
Yay!
They were working together on a large radio antenna for Bell Labs when they heard a signal that they could not identify. They removed all sources of the sound, including pigeon poop, from the radio antenna, and the noise was still there. Eventually, they determined that the signal was the CMB, which serves as powerful support for the Big Bang Theory.
Arguably, or at least I've seen it argued, one of the least deserved Nobel Prize winners in history, Wilson and Penzias, because they were just lucky.
Yes,
and
they were lucky.
Very little else.
Yeah, but they still discovered the CMB.
Other people were looking for it and predicted it.
Yeah. And these guys had a very, very big radio antenna that just happened to be sensitive enough to pick up this low-level background hum of static, yeah, which is the CMB. And the cosmic microwave background is, as the name suggests, a very nearly uniformly distributed and uniform temperature background radiation.
Was it like 4 Kelvin or something?
2.7 Kelvin, I think.
Ah, okay.
That is which pervasive is across the entire universe. No matter which direction you look in, there's this uniform radiation. And it's at that temperature because of the time it takes for the radiation to reach Earth.
Awesome.
It's redshifted very, very far.
13.7 billion years.
Mm. Something like that.
Give or take.
That's as far as we can see.
Oh,
13.7?
There,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly.
That's
the best guess. And you can see it, the cosmic microwave background, of course.
On your TV.
On your television. Yes.
Yeah,
and
some
you can
percentage.
Hear it on your radio.
No, 1%. 1% of the static you see on your TV.
Cool.
Nice. All right. Well,
I demand a Nobel Prize for Owen for discovering that.
Yeah, so do I. I demand that too.
Owen didn't discover it.
I did.
Well, he did. He just did, clearly.
No,
yeah.
He stated it. That's not the same thing.
I discovered it. I discovered it on the internet.
And exactly. No, I'm not even going to ask. Just carry on.
All right. Okay, well, let's move on to updates. And I have a little update from last week where I spoke about using science for personal gain. And I spoke about aircon wars in the office.
I remember that.
Oh, it was awesome. And I found out an interesting story this week that you might be able to use as ammunition in your ongoing war to keep the office cool. And that comes from a guy by the name of Ray Cronies. Now, Ray Cronies is a NASA scientist who happened across some old U.S. military research looking into how to prevent soldiers from losing too much weight in cold climates. And now, Ray Cronies at the time was an overweight dude, and he thought that he might be able to use this research to his advantage. So he did. So he developed a procedure, or has developed a procedure, which he calls thermal loading, in which he exposes himself to really cold temperatures. And in doing so, lost like a whole lot of weight, something like 120 pounds or something ridiculous, whatever that is in kilograms.
That's 60 kilograms.
Not a real measurement.
Pounds. Is that just from sitting in a cold room?
No. It also involved, you know, so changing diets and exercising and that kind of stuff. But he reckons that the cold exposure contributed in a big way. And the way he justifies it is this. Michael Phelps.
The swimmer.
Yeah. He consumes, apparently, 12,000 calories a day, which is far in excess of a normal human caloric intake, normal human male caloric intake, which is about 2,500 a day.
He also swims a lot.
Yes, he does. He swims for about 4 hours a day. But that's not enough to justify expending all those calories. So what Cronin's theorized is that because he's in the water, he's in the cold, he has to use more energy to keep himself warm because the cold water is drawing the heat out of his body, which is an interesting hypothesis.
Look, I mean, you would imagine that if you are cold, your body has to use some of its stored energy in order to warm itself up. But
how much?
I'm not buying it. I'm sorry. Well, I'm just not buying that this is a great weight loss strategy. I think that if we perhaps had some kind of a way to test what he would have lost with and without the cold, then I might be more inclined to believe it. But at this point, I'm not convinced.
Yeah, no, look, there's definitely room for skepticism here. It hasn't been peer-reviewed research or anything like that. That still needs to happen. But I think it's a very compelling hypothesis. And I think it's convincing enough to use his TED Talk as ammunition in the war.
There's a TED Talk.
Yes, there's a TED Talk. He was on TEDMed.
There are TED Talks for lots of things.
No, I know. But he makes a very good case for it, and I find it quite convincing. So, yes. Well, especially when your adversaries in the aircon wars are not scientifically literate, this one will definitely be a strong weapon in your arsenal.
I thought you were a white science knowledge-er.
What are you saying? What? Are you calling me racist?
No, he's calling you a black hat science geek.
No, I'm not against using science for evil.
You're a black hat skeptic, basically.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Except for the company I work in right now, I have never worked in a company that had an aircon where there weren't problems with the aircon temperature settings.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go, half the office wants it hotter, half the office wants it colder. Nobody can settle on anything. Pervasive.
Yeah, no, there's just too much variation in how comfortable people are in given temperatures. And there are a lot of people who just don't care one way or another. They're just not that affected by temperatures. But there are people like me who are very sensitive to temperature.
You know what the Greeks would do? They draw lots and appoint a dictator to determine for a certain period of time who gets to set the temperature.
Well, I'm on board with that.
I think we should do that.
I think dictatorships should be decided by feats of strength. I think all important decisions should be decided by feats of strength, really, but especially this one.
Says the biggest guy in the office.
Well, you know, that's debatable. Between Mike and I think we've got it covered, though.
Anyway, so shall we move on to the news?
Yes, well, okay. So the first news story we have this week is about an Antarctic sauropod fossil.
Cool.
Cool.
Indeed. And the first titanosaur fossil has been discovered in Antarctica. Kind of.
What do you mean kind of? Kind of been discovered, or it's kind of been discovered in Antarctica?
Was it kind of a titanosaur?
No, it's definitely a titanosaur, and it's definitely been discovered, but it's kind of in Antarctica. It's actually in James Ross Island, which is just off the coast of Antarctica. But it's, you know, it's close enough.
That counts.
So it's an island close to Antarctica.
Though. Yeah, yeah.
Like Robben Island.
Like really close, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's close enough. It's fine.
Okay. Did they swim there?
They probably did not swim there.
Is there a prison there?
Not that I'm aware of.
No chance for a good movie there. No swimming dinosaurs, no prisons.
No, it's stupid. It's a stupid movie. No, yeah. Anyway, so Ignacio Cerda from the National University of Comahue in Argentina and his colleagues, they published the discovery of a sauropod fossil on James Ross Island. Now, sauropods are a suborder of dinosaurs that are typically large, long-necked, long-tailed herbivores.
Like the Brontosaurus.
Yes, except it's not called the Brontosaurus. It's called the Patasaurus.
I don't like a Patasaurus.
I don't want a Patasaurus.
You want a Patasaurus because it's very cute. Yeah, well, it's huge, but it's also cute for a huge dinosaur.
I didn't know it's cute.
Well, because, you know.
You deduced that from a single vertebra.
Kind of, vertebra. Yes. Yeah. Oh, how could it be? Do it all the time in paleontology. Now, also in the sauropods, you have Diplodocus and Brachiosaurus. You'll probably remember Brachiosaurus from Jurassic Park. It was the big one when they were up in the tree, that one.
Yeah, the one that sneezed on them.
Yes, that's the one. So this specific fossil is just a vertebra, and yes, it's just one vertebra of what appears to be a member of the titanosaur branch of sauropods. So sauropods are quite a diverse family of dinosaurs, and titanosaurs are one of the suborders. Now, titanosaurs include some of the largest mammals, and not mammals, some of the largest animals ever to walk the earth, which includes Argentinosaurus, which was flippin' huge.
It was the size of Argentina.
Exactly. Yeah, just imagine like a really big dinosaur and then think bigger than that. That's about how big Titanus was.
New York State?
No, not that big.
But
still big. Like, so this specimen probably wasn't an Argentinosaurus. It was probably from the clade Lithostroacia, which means that it's probably more closely related to Saltosaurus. Now, Saltosaurus was a roughly elephant-sized dinosaur with rows of blunt spines down its back.
What's a clade?
A clade is a taxonomical thingy.
It is. It is a taxonomical group.
Yes. So a clade is the is a taxonomical classification between superfamily and family. So now the interesting thing here, another interesting thing here, is that most news sources are reporting that this is the first sauropod to have been discovered in Antarctica, which is in fact not the case. And it's not surprising that they're reporting that, because the scientists themselves make that claim in their paper. Indeed. So those scientists obviously didn't spend 10 minutes looking through Wikipedia, Googling for Antarctic sauropods.
That is embarrassing.
It is kind of embarrassing. Because in 2007, Nathan Smith and Diego Paul named the species Glacialosaurus hemeri, which is an early bipedal sauropod discovered in the interior of Antarctica on the Transantarctic Mountains.
So it's on the actual Antarctica, not just an island off.
Is this not considered to be a legitimate animal? It hasn't been rescinded or reclassified?
As far as I can tell, there have been several reanalyses of the Glacialosaurus remains, and they've all concurred that this is an early sauropod.
What seems to have happened is that I looked at the paper, and the scientists in question cite a source from 2004.
There we go. That makes sense.
So they read that in that source, and then apparently they just didn't update themselves.
That makes sense at least. So at least two other species of dinosaurs have been discovered in Antarctica before. We've got Antarctopelta, which is closely related to Ankylosaurus. And we have Cryolophosaurus, which is a theropod from the same family as Dilophosaurus.
Was that Cryotosaurus?
Cryolophosaurus.
Cryolophosaurus.
Yes. Yeah, that works actually. This unfortunately, this newly discovered titanosaur, it's just a vertebra, and that means there isn't enough of a specimen for us to identify what species it is. So we don't know if it's a new species or not.
Yeah, we need some more bones.
Yeah. So these guys need to just go back and dig some more, because they're just not trying hard enough.
Get your picks out, boys.
Yeah, let's go.
You're going back.
It's not as if it's cold there or anything.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even really Antarctica.
Yeah. And
and we sit in our chairs comfortably talking about it. Right.
Yeah.
We just tell them about Ray Cronus's study about how they'll lose weight if they go there. And they'll be psyched about it.
Totally psyched. Good plan.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next story, which is about bees.
You know, it occurs to me that if that study is true, then the proportion of any population that's fat should vary by latitude.
It probably should, you're right.
Controlling for caloric intake and economic situation. But anyway, talking about bees. So because it's me who chose the story and not Owen, luckily it does not involve colony collapse disorder. Nor does it involve cell phones.
But what is there interesting to say about bees that isn't about colony collapse disorder and cell phones? I don't understand.
Well, it's my mission in this segment or this item to show you that there might be something interesting.
There's more to bees than CCD.
Yes, I mean, there is more. So according to a paper by Christoph Grotera and Cristiano Menzies from the Universities of Sao Paulo and University of Sussex and colleagues in PNAS, there's a species of bee that is morphologically differentiated by cost. So as you may know, in ants in some ants and some termites, there are well-defined types of that creature. So there's the worker ant, and then there's the soldier ant, and they're morphologically quite different. So they are morphologically specialized for one kind of job. So the soldiers with their big heads and massive jaws and larger bodies and greater strength are specialized for fighting, for example. Now, for reasons that are not well understood, until now, bees, which are also social insects like the ants and the termites, they're all eusocial, which is a type of sexual organization where there is one reproducing either a pair or just a queen in the case of bees, ants, and termites, and then a huge colony of really sisters who help out. And this type of morphological specialization had not been seen in bees before, which I found quite surprising, really. I mean, I'd sort of known it, but not realized that I'd known it. But now there's a type of bee called the jatai, or it's found in Brazil, and it's also known as the neotropical stingless bee, or Tetragonisca angustura. This bee, it's fairly typical, other than the fact that it's stingless, so it doesn't. It doesn't have a stinger like most other bees, and they have a queen and about 10,000 workers in their colonies on average or most of the time. And according to this paper, this jatai actually has castes in its social organization. So it has a soldier type bee that does nothing else for its entire life. So they discovered this by studying these bees in Sao Paulo State at one of the researchers' farms, and they marked them with dots so they could follow individual bees and study them. And what they realized that is that there are always bees at the entrance of the nest. So there's a wax tube leading into the actual nest, and there are always guard bees at the actual entrance. In addition, there are a bunch of bees that hover nearby, and they do guard duty for a very long time, up to 3 weeks, according to some previous research published by these same scientists. And, I mean, as you can imagine, 3 weeks is a very long time for an insect.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's probably like its entire lifespan, just about.
Yeah, pretty much, I think. And in other bees, how it tends to work is that they are specialized by age. So, you know, maybe in day five, you are a worker. I mean, you're a guard bee for 1 day, and then you go on to become a forager, right? So the bees graduate as they get older and wear down more. They travel further to go forage and so on, right? Because those are more dangerous jobs. So the older bees take those jobs on. But these guys specialize from birth, really. And the guards are, as I said, morphologically specialized. There's little overlap in their morphological characteristics. The soldier bees are about 30% heavier than foragers. They have smaller heads in proportion to the rest of their bodies, as well as larger hind legs. And roughly 1 to 2% of the emerging bees are guards, and around 1% of the bees in any given colony actually is performing that function at any given time. So, you know, that's all very, you know, nice that we see this behavioral difference and there might be this morphological difference, but you have to wonder, are these bees actually different when the shit hits the fan, as it were? So to test this, the scientists staged fights between these bees.
Wow.
Bee fighting. Awesome.
Exactly, bee fighting. So there's this species of robber bee called Lestrimelita limau, which, as far as I can understand it, there's not very much published information on this bee, but as I understand it, these guys don't make their own honey or collect their own food. They're a colony, but they specialize, they're very large, and they specialize in invading the nests of other bees and stealing their food. So it's a little bit like the slave-making ants that have a sort of a similar lifestyle. And these guys very often destroy whole colonies. And the robber bees and this jatai bee are natural enemies. So what the scientists did is they stage fights between these guys.
That's epic.
And when they did these fights, it turned out that the soldier bees were a lot better at fighting them than other types of bees. So a worker or a forager bee. And as a result, they were able to survive longer. Even though they did die in the end because they're so much smaller, they did last quite a bit longer. And what their strategy seems to be is to bite onto the wings of the robber bees. And that immobilizes them.
Wow, awesome.
giving them time to recruit more allies to come fight in their cause.
Excellent. Cool. That's a cool strategy.
Indeed. And there's quite a bit of video available. We'll link to the University of Sussex website, where there are three videos clearly showing these behaviors, including a video of a B-on-B brawl, which is awesome.
This sort of reminds me of ants.
Yeah.
Which have specialized castes and morphological differences between the different groups, the soldiers and the queens and the workers and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very similar.
Yeah. Well, they're fairly closely related. They're both part of the Hymenoptera gene. What's the word?
Superfamily.
Superfamily of insects.
Okay, cool. Very interesting. And the video is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, check out the video. It's freaking awesome. It reminds me of like a squadron of gunships like hovering over the battlefield. It's epic.
It's not the behavior I'm used to seeing.
Yeah. And of course, humans are also morphologically specialized in the same way because we have Bucky's Buerta.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is the soldier.
He's the soldier bee. And the rest of us are just the regular mooks.
Anyway, so this is really awesome. It's always nice when something new is discovered about a really important form of life.
Hmm.
And it's interesting how nature's never neat. It's not like all bees do X and all ants do Y. It's always going to bleed over. And I mean, it seems significant to me that these guys are stingless.
Mm.
That, you know, so far at least, there are no bees with stingers who have castes of soldiers, because perhaps they don't need it because the worker bees are well armed.
Right.
Yeah, they can protect themselves.
And they can sting intruders. But because these guys are stingless, they can't use that poison or they can't use that venom. And as a result, they have to resort to having an actually just larger type of bee.
Right, right.
Moving on to Yeti. Are we talking about me again?
Yes.
Mm. Yay!
A few months ago, I think it was in about September, we discussed a Russian expedition to send a really big boxer to go commune with
Beast
the Yetis.
From the east.
Yes. He was going to go out into the Russian bushveld or whatever they have.
Tundra.
Into the Russian tundra to commune with the Yetis. That failed. That expedition failed.
No, it didn't fail, because remember, his argument was the fact that he didn't find them proved that they exist.
Yeah.
Right.
It proves that they're peaceful.
It proves that they're peaceful.
They were scared of him.
Yeah.
No, they were peaceful because they were avoiding conflict with the humans.
Yes. Obviously.
Of course.
So we have a follow-up Russian Yeti story.
Yay.
Published in The Star, which is a local South African newspaper, at the beginning of this year, is a story about Russian border guards capturing a live Yeti.
Awesome.
And imprisoning it in a cage in a private zoo, guys.
Well, that's awesome. That's exactly the evidence we've been waiting
for. Exactly. There's a live Yeti in a cage. Now everyone can go and look.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Now we know. Awesome. Now we can put that one to bed.
Let me give you some more details, though, before we go to sleep.
All right.
This story is being reported by Interfax News Agency out of Russia,
which is notoriously reliable.
Yes. Uh-huh. On the 30th of December. And apparently the Yeti was captured by Russian border guards after it was shot and wounded by a hunter who thought it was a bear.
Right.
It ran away on its back legs, so he called the authorities.
Right. Well, that's still consistent with the bear.
So I'm still
favoring the bear hypothesis.
But bears don't run on the legs.
Hang on now. Bears run on all fours.
That's true.
Apparently, it looks like a gorilla. It's about 2 meters tall and is very massive.
Hmm. Wait, so that boxer is definitely accounted for.
Well, they do mention him briefly, but I don't know whether or not we have species confusion.
Okay.
So, apparently, this Yeti is being held in a private zoo in the village of Sirkaki in Ingushetia's Nazran district, which is about 1,480 kilometers south of Moscow.
Ingushetia is a country in the Caucasus, near Chechnya.
We will link to a video provided by Interfax of the actual Yeti in the actual cage, guys.
In the actual costume.
Wait, what?
So, I've got a quote from Bagautin Marshani, the former head of the Labor Ministry of the territory of Ingushetia.
Oh, no.
This is how you know it's legit, guys, because they have a former head of Labor.
Yeah.
He says it growls and makes strange sounds and eats meat and vegetables. Some people say it's an abominable snowman, and others say that it's a great ape. But honestly, I've never seen anything like it.
I have.
Yeah.
Because I've seen men in gorilla suits before. Yes.
Also, it fits all of those descriptions. Abominable snowman, great ape, eats meat and vegetables, growls and makes strange sounds. All of those consistent with a dude in a gorilla suit.
Yes. So, after my dad told me about the story, because I did get this story from my dad, I Googled it and I found YouTube videos of... Okay, they are in Russian, but they seem very much to link up with the story. I can't say exactly, but there's a lot of the same footage and the story seems to correlate with what we have in words. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking them as being the same thing. And there is a video of the newsman telling us all about the Yeti in Russian, and then the video of the Yeti itself. And it looks like a small man in a really, really bad gorilla costume. It's always in the dark. You never see any definition. It's just a shadowy figure walking up and down in a cage and like swinging its arms in a funny way.
Yeah. It looks like a dude pretending to be a Yeti
in a gorilla suit. But actually just a dude. It is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
I mean, if you've been to the zoo, you've seen what a caged ape, a caged non-human ape looks like, right? You see how a non-human ape moves. You kind of get a sense for what a non-human ape looks like in the wild and in captivity. This doesn't look like that.
No.
It looks like a dude in a suit.
Pretending to be an ape.
Exactly.
I don't think he's even pretending very hard. He doesn't walk funny.
He's not trying.
At
he just
point,
walks.
At one point, he like crouches a little bit.
Yeah, slouches
and, like,
his head a little.
Puts his hand up on the cage when the guy looks directly at him.
Yeah.
It is pathetic.
Yeah, no, seriously. If we decided to do something like this, we could do better in like a day.
Yeah.
Give us a day, we could do better than this. Yeah. Seriously. Yeah.
Like a, you know, what, $400 to rent a nice gorilla suit from Jod's Costume Hire.
Yeah, I would have to put you in it, though, because you're almost 7 feet tall.
I don't know if they make it in my size, but, you know, close enough.
So, in this video, there's a guy standing in front of the cage, and he's talking away. And he looks at the guy in the cage, and he looks back. And as he looks back at the screen, you can see he is suppressing the biggest smile in the world. You can see this is a hoax. And it is.
But of course, the thing is, the thing was shot, right?
Apparently. Yeah.
So a vet needed to have come to see it. Now this vet, being a trained medical professional, will immediately recognize a new type of species.
Which means he is entitled to a Nobel Prize.
Well, not Nobel,
but you know, certainly some recognition.
He's entitled to a paper in the most prestigious journal he can choose. He can choose science. Yeah. He can choose nature.
Right.
He can choose whatever he likes. He can name his price, and he become famous overnight, become a celebrity, and you know, Attenborough would fly over to Ingushetia and make a docu about it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. In the next week.
Yeah. Absolutely, it would be the biggest find of the century, and it's only 2012.
The millennium.
Yeah, exactly. This is the freaking Yeti we're talking about here. So, yeah, it's a hoax, and I am pretty sure we're going to not hear or see anything out of the star further.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's some kind of New Year's prank put on by the news service that reported it.
Yeah, it's got that sort of feeling.
That's possible.
The cameraman would probably have to be in on it.
Oh, yes. The cameraman would have to be in on it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Or they just use the crappy footage.
Yeah, I suppose. That's
in editing.
That's possible.
But, and the thing is, though, that this belief seems... I haven't seen public opinion polls or anything like that, but this belief in the Yeti seems very widespread in Russia, judging from the number of stories that come from that country reporting, you know, scientists, you know, there was that whole conference and seemingly reputable Russian scientists at seemingly reputable institutions buy hook, line, and sinker into this Yeti thing, which is
sad.
It's like a cultural belief, I suppose.
Yeah, it seems to be.
And it's such a big country, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to think, well, okay, so such a big country, so few people.
There could be a Yeti.
Exactly.
Anyway.
BS.
BS. Total and utter unadulterated bollocks.
And seriously, next time, give the guy some more vodka so he walks around
Not like a person.
Yeah, not like a person, please. Yeah. So he shuffles or something.
Instead of swinging his arms, walking like a person.
Yeah. Like a dude. Like a dude in a suit.
We're going to feel like such idiots if this story turns out to be true.
I think we're safe. If this story turns out to be true, I will eat my hat.
Yeah.
I won't, because I like my hat. But
I don't even own a hat.
I more hats than I care to wear, but they're probably none of them probably taste very nice. But I don't really want to eat my hat.
You know, that's a niche in the market. Nice tasting hats.
Yeah, that's true.
So you can say, I'll eat my hat.
Yeah. And it tastes like strawberry milkshake or something. That'd be awesome.
Awesome. Excellent.
Let's do it, guys.
Let's do it. We'll make millions. Okay, we'll make hundreds.
Okay, we might sell a few.
We'll not lose millions. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we'll make hundreds of rand.
If we're lucky.
Tens.
Hundreds of cents.
We'll make tens of rand.
Anyways, shall we move on to the results of our last quiz, which we don't have because we haven't posted the episode.
Yeah, sorry, everybody. We have had severe internet problems. And
As in not having it.
Yeah, we basically have no internet.
We're a bit behind ourselves at the moment.
We promise we will post everything and we will put up the quiz and we will report on it next week. It's a good one.
Yes, let's do our link of the week.
Alrighty, Michael, first up.
Yeah, I have very good news for you. I have a legitimate reason, a legitimate educational and scientific reason for you to buy Playboy this month.
Awesome. What?
Michael, you have won the podcast.
Well, other than the legitimate scientific research you can conduct on bust sizes and hip to waist ratios. And
Okay, boys, back on point.
Memory glands are interesting.
Michael, back to this podcast.
Anyway, so Carl Zimmer, notorious, but
our friend
Carl Zimmer, the famous science journalist who specializes in biology most of the time, has written a profile of the fantastic Neil deGrasse Tyson for Playboy. Now, some of you might not know this, but when someone says, I read Playboy for the articles, they might not necessarily be lying. Yeah, because Playboy had really genuinely, the boobies help, but the articles are actually really fantastic. Mm. And they're very famous for their interviews as well.
Wasn't Stephen King, didn't he publish a whole series of short stories in the Playboy as well?
He did. They've interviewed most of the U.S. presidents on Playboy. They've Martin Luther King Jr. they interviewed. You know, they're famous because it's actually a good quality magazine.
Not all
in between
porn.
The soft porn. Right. Anyway, so Zimmer has produced this really fantastic profile of Neil deGrasse Tyson. And as you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is one of the most well-known science popularizers in the world, or at least in the US, and he's also the host of the remake of Cosmos that's coming out, I think in 2013.
Something like that.
And he is minted from pure awesomeness. Yeah.
Also, he's Batman.
Yes. He is?
Yeah. He is made of adamantium awesomeness.
He's Batman. Seriously.
He is Batman.
He is Batman, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Who else could be that? Awesome.
Yeah, obviously it's Batman. There's nobody else. There's no other candidates. So obviously Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So anyway, have a look. The article is not available on the Playboy website, but it is available entirely free of charge and in its entirety on Carl Zimmer's website. And there are no pictures of naked women in case you want to read it at work. Well, we'll link to it.
Is it in the South African edition of Playboy or is it only in the American edition?
I think we need to find out.
We need to do some field research, boys.
I know for a fact it's the US edition it's published in, and I know also for a fact that the various editions of Playboy have different editors and have different articles in them. So whether they choose to publish this article or not, I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like research is required.
Sounds like it. Where are you going to get the US edition?
You can buy it in SA.
Okay. Alrighty. Okay. Owen, what's your link of the week?
My link of the week is to the website of our parent organization or sponsoring organization. Parent organization, the Gauteng Skeptics.
Yay! Round of applause.
Indeed. The website is awesome. It's run by our web guru, James Hoff. And it's a nice resource if you want to find out what's happening in skepticism in South Africa. If you want to see where the skeptics in the pub is happening and you don't listen to our podcast, then you can go there.
Wow.
We've got big plans for other content that we'll be introducing to the website as we go. And it's going to be really cool. And once we get around to formalizing the membership side of Gauteng Skeptics, the announcements will be made there. So that's the place to keep your eye.
Yep.
So if you're a skeptic in Gauteng, head along to this Gauteng Skeptics website, subscribe to the RSS feed, and add it to your bookmarks, and go check in every now and then.
And we will try to write something for it.
Well, we totally will.
Cool.
Try.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So my link of the week this week is to the California Academy of Sciences and their list of new species described in 2011.
Nice. Leap roach being one of them.
Not that I saw, actually.
Wasn't that in 2010?
It may well have been in 2010.
I'm pretty sure this is the same man.
Okay. But also, it might not be inclusive of every single species that was described. This is just specifically the California Academy of Sciences list.
Oh, I see.
Okay. But it's very cool. They've got something like 140 species on the list, and 12 of them are from South Africa.
Nice.
Including ants and sea slugs and sharks.
Sharks?
Sharks. New, cool. Two new species of
shark. Do they eat any people?
I don't think so.
Damn. Well, what uses of a shark if they can't bite?
You can still make soup out of it.
They're clearly not very good at eating people. I mean, I was there. I went to Simonstown. I went kayaking. I went swimming. And there were no sharks. No, I didn't see shark one.
You don't look like a seal enough. You should wear your gorilla suit.
Well, like a leopard seal, dude.
I did my best seal impression and still no sharks.
Did you play with a ball?
I did a little bit, actually.
That's overshared.
Yeah.
Yes, his one testicle didn't descend.
Oh, God. Oh,
so, you know, I'm not all that impressed with sharks' ability to attack people, but, you know, there you go.
Well, we're not their natural prey.
Yeah.
So but what would you expect?
Were there any cute species on the list? Because sometimes there are, like, little nahapis and things. Nothing. Just all hohos and fish.
Mostly hohos and fish.
I mean, your use of South African slang is really confusing anyone who's not South African.
Sorry. Just all insects and fish.
Yeah, hoho is a creepy crawly, so that's an insect or an arachnid or...
There was some moss.
Some kind of arthropod. Moss.
Moss discovered...
Moss is cute.
Moss is kind of cute.
That's discovered in... Alrighty. Cool. So that's that for our awesome. Link of the week.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to our quote of the week. And we're back to having our science fiction and fantasy quotes. This one is said by Superboy, and it comes from Superboy number 4, which was written by Scott Lobdell. And it goes like this. Faith is never an answer. It's just a restatement of a question.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. That's our first quote from a comic book.
Nice.
Yes, indeed.
Cool.
I'm going to quote from another comic book.
Go for it.
The Walking Dead. Mm. Roar.
Awesome.
Too stupid to live. You use homeopathy.
Okay, well, shall we move on to our announcements?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, we've got lots of announcements this week. So, listeners, you might want to hit the pause button and get yourself a paper and pencil or like a tablet or something.
We'll just go to the website.
Preferably an iPad.
We link.
Yeah. Oh, you can do that too if you like. Let's see. First up, we've got Durban. In Durban, we have a Skeptics in the Pub, which is happening on Thursday, the 19th of January at 6 p.m. And it's happening at the usual venue, which is Pizzetta. That's in Davenport Road in Glenwood.
Awesome.
Indeed.
Second up, we have Skeptics in the Pub in Cape Town, which is on Friday the 20th of January at 7 o'clock at Beliza, on the corner of Burnside and Kloofneck Road in Tamboerskloof.
Then Joburg Skeptics in the Park, I almost said pub, is Sunday 22nd January 2012. Bring along a portable TV if you have one to watch the cricket at 1 o'clock at Zoo Lake. And it's going to be monthly on the third Sunday of the month. Are we still going to do it in the pub as well, or are we just doing it in the park?
We're going to do it in the pub.
We'll both.
Do
in the pub, yeah. Our next Skeptics in the Pub will be in early February, but we'll announce that closer to the time.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. So for Skeptics in the Pub, just show up at the park. We'll be somewhere near the Moya restaurant. If we have bad weather, then we'll just slip inside the restaurant.
Yep.
You can bring your children or your dogs.
Yeah,
or
please. Bring the kids. Bring the cricket bats, the soccer balls, the whole shebang.
Oh, sunscreen. Don't forget your sunscreen.
Yes, and hats.
Yes.
And your homeopathic medicines for in case of bee stings.
Right.
No. Bring real medicine in case of bee stings.
How will people recognize us?
We will be sitting there looking quite skeptical.
Now we need some kind of you're going to wear some kind of loud t-shirt.
Yes, you'll recognize me because I'm the hairy giant guy wearing a skeptical t-shirt. So okay. It'll probably be like flying spaghetti
monster. A Star Trek uniform.
I'm not going to go in uniform on a midsummer's day. It's a bit uncomfortable. It's slightly uncomfortable, but I'll probably wear like a flying spaghetti monster
t-shirt. Dude, if a Star Trek officer can fight a man in a lizard suit in the desert in his uniform, then you could just go to the park in one. Come on.
I might be a Starship captain, but I'm no Captain Kirk.
Nobody is.
Okay. Well, our next on the list is in Pretoria, and that's also Skeptics in the Pub. And that's happening on Saturday, the 28th of January at 12:30. The venue will be decided, so check out the Facebook page and for updates.
Cool.
And then we have some appearances, because we're famous on the internet and stuff.
Well, only one appearance.
Oh, okay. And that was me. I appeared a couple of weeks ago in a South African podcast about atheism called Primordial Soup. I was on their episode number 20, and we'll link to that in the show notes. You can head along and listen to what I have to say about atheism and comic books and Jesus and science and things like that.
If you ever wanted to know what Owen Swart thought about comic books featuring Jesus that have an atheistic theme, head over to Primordial Soup.
Totally. I'm full of opinions about that kind of thing. Well, I think that's all we've got, guys.
Yeah, it's a little bit short tonight, but we have been thunderstormed.
Yes, and you listeners, quit being so selfish. You had a long episode last week.
No one's complained. You're just anticipating the non-existent listener feedback.
All right. Angela, where can people find you on the internet?
The best place where you can find me, where all of my stuff is, that's my blogs and my books and my goings forth, is at about.me/AngelaMeaden.
Awesome.
And Owen, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at owenswart.org.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is.
And I am on Google+. Just search for Michael Meaden.
Yes, that's a good place. And as of today, Google has launched their Google profiles in search. So you can probably just go to the Google and search Michael Meaden and you'll find him on Google+ there.
Cool.
That's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-hosts and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Have been listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. Theme music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
I have moss on my lap all the time to pet it.
Michael, you should bath more often.
I mean, Kate.
Wow.
I think we should take that out. That was terrible.
Seriously, that was awful.
I thought it would be funny.
We didn't even give you a sympathy laugh, Mike.